This is Saturday Night and Sunday Morning, the Gospel Roots of Rock and Soul. I'm your host, Cece Winans. In this hour, gospel goes mainstream. From the rock and roll roaring out of Memphis, Tennessee.
Train a ride.
To Mahalia Jackson reigning as the Queen of Gospel in Chicago.
Go to blue, Ohio.
To the Detroit sounds of Motown and Aretha Franklin.
Yeah.
These artists gave gospel a starring role on the pop music charts. Today we hear the sounds of gospel anytime a singer reaches for a high note or fronts a choir. American pop would never be the same.
When the praises go up,
the blessings come down.
After this.
When the praises go up.
For those of you that think that gospel music has gone too far, you think we've gotten too radical with our message? Well, I got news for you. You ain't heard nothing yet. And if you don't know, now you know. Glory, glory! Woo! You better put them hands together and act like you know up in here. Chief Pete! Church up in here. Come on, chat.
I can't explain.
Uh-huh.
I can't obtain.
Uh-huh.
Jesus, your love is so, it's so amazing. It gets me high up to the sky.
Hallelujah.
And when I think about your goodness, it makes me wanna stomp.
You can't take my joy, devil. Makes me cry. Them hands together and have a Holy Ghost party with me. No weapon formed against me shall prosper. I'm more than a conqueror. Can I get a witness up in here? People say,
stop.
Everybody say,
stop.
You're listening to Saturday Night and Sunday Morning, the gospel roots of rock and soul. I'm Cece Winans. Midway through the 20th century, America and its allies united to triumph over fascism. The most important post-war alliance for music lovers, though, brought together gospel, R&B, blues, and country. You could hear it all over AM radio in Memphis, Tennessee.
And man, we've been playing the last,
at WHBQ, DJ Dewey Phillips hosted the popular show Red Hot and Blue.
It is Strange Things Happening Every Day by Sister Rosetta Thorne.
Over at rival station WDIA, young Riley King helped pioneer the first all-race music format in the country. Race meant black, and this DJ would soon earn the nickname BB, short for Blues Boy King. Sunday nights, WHBQ delivered Reverend W. Herbert Brewster's Camp Meeting of the Air from East Trigg Baptist Church.
And I, too, can say I am so glad I've got good religion.
Deanie Parker from the legendary Memphis label Stax Records tuned in regularly.
I do remember listening to Reverend Brewster's sermons that were recorded one Sunday in advance and replayed the next Sunday. He was a prolific poet. I liked his messages. And, you know, I liked the songs.
Another faithful listener was Memphis native and future WDIA personality, Mark Stansberry.
I believe I was, 11 or 12 years old at Leith School. And my teacher was Miss Juanita Brewster at the time, and that's Dr. W. Herbert Brewster's daughter. And against my mother's wishes, I rode my bicycle up busy Union Avenue, which is right up the street here. And Nat D. Williams was the first African-American DJ. And Nat invited me in and interviewed me. And he made a great impression on me. And at the time, you know, I said that I think I want to be like Nat D.
The musical mix on the radio challenged the racial status quo in deeply segregated Memphis.
What you saw in radio was not true integration.
Writer and critic Ann Powers has studied the post-war pop music scene.
You know, it wasn't like black and white DJs were necessarily sharing the mic, or even that black artists would be played right next to white artists all the time.
People from all over poured into Memphis for post-war job opportunities. That influx included musicians who started borrowing ideas from each other. Take the Blackwood Brothers, a white gospel quartet from Choctaw County, Mississippi. When they moved to Memphis in 1950, they would have heard groups like the Soul Stirrers on WDIA.
I can tell the world about this. I can tell the nation that I'm blessed. Tell them what my Jesus has done. Tell them that the Comforter has come. And he brought joy, great joy unto my soul. Well, my Lord, he done just what he said.
Music historian Ann Powers told us,
it isn't that complicated to see how white Southern gospel quartets like the Blackwood Brothers and the Statesmen did pretty much borrow directly from black gospel.
Well, my Lord done just what he said.
Yes, he did. Yes, he did.
He hears the candy rings and
did.
Yes, he did.
Yes, he did. Well, he brought joy, great joy unto my soul.
But some elements, white groups like the Blackwood Brothers just couldn't copy. Longtime Stax Record publicist Deanie Parker.
I want to make another statement about gospel music. And that is that it comes out of the souls of black people. I'm not suggesting to you that there isn't gospel in those arcs. You understand what I'm saying? In Appalachia, there is gospel. But the gospel that I grew up on, that I cut my teeth on, that moves me, is the gospel about which I am talking. Okay, and it's different. It's different.
Unto my soul, he brought joy. Unto my soul, he brought joy. Unto my, she's been here, my Lord, bless my soul and gone away.
Many white parents didn't want their children listening to any black music, not even gospel songs. If all those kids had obeyed, we wouldn't have rock and roll. But for white audiences who did avoid black music, groups like the Blackwood Brothers brought gospel sounds to them anyway. So, in his way, did Sam Phillips. Sam grew up in Florence, Alabama. At a local radio station, he met Becky Burns and they got married. In 1945, they headed north to Tennessee.
So he always knew he wanted to move to Memphis. He had, it was a short time in Nashville, but moved to Memphis and recorded big bands at the Peabody. And the whole time he's dreaming of starting his own little studio.
Matt Ross Spang runs the Sam Phillips Recording Service in Memphis. That company's namesake founded it as Sun Records in 1950.
Primarily just recording black artists.
Sam was white. The musicians he recorded deferred to him and observed local customs.
And he said they would come in and they would play the music that they thought he wanted to hear. You know, what they would maybe be paid to play at a show. And he said, I want you to play what you play at home. And he said it took a long time for them to open up to do that. And a lot of that would be gospel, but a lot of it would be just gut bucket blue, you know, because Howl and Wolf, these guys had radio shows, so they were thinking they wanted to hear, you know, I'll Fly Away.
When Sam set up his studio, he hoped that if the world could hear black musicians make this music that he loved, they'd fall in love with it too. And that could break down the color line. Matt Ross Spang told us,
he had, you know, Howl and Wolf, he had Ike Turner, Junior Parker, B.B. King, Joe Hill Lewis. They all came to him. And Ike Turner was kind of a talent scout. So once he recorded Ike Turner, he would tell like B.B. King, you got to go. There's this crazy white man that'll record you and sell it and help you get a record deal and stuff. And he treated them fairly. He didn't rip them off like most people did.
Sam went out of his way to scout talent and put it on vinyl. Warden James E. Edwards of the Nashville State Penitentiary led a group of five singers perform around Nashville to promote the work he was doing to rehabilitate prisoners. That group, the Prisoners, reached Sam's ears. He liked what he heard and arranged to have the Prisoners transported under armed guard from Nashville to his Memphis studio. Group leader Johnny Bragg wrote this single.
Just walking in the rain, getting soaking wet, torture in my heart, by trying to forget. Just walking in the rain.
Just Walking in the Rain was Sun Records' very first hit. A couple of months later, Sam brought the Prisoners back to his studio.
There are some things I may not know. But as for me,
local newspaper sent a staffer to Sun Records for photos and an article about the prison air's success.
And it also mentioned that Sam records anything, anywhere, anytime.
Again, Matt Ross Spang.
You could come in and do a novelty recording. You could pay $3 and cut direct to disc.
To an 18-year-old who had moved with his parents from Tupelo, Mississippi to Memphis, that sounded like a pretty good deal.
And I think Elvis read this and thought, well, if prisoners can record there, and these people, I can go in there and pay $3 and make a record. So he came in, I think, 4 or 5 days after that.
One thing you have to remember about Elvis is that he was poor. He was very poor.
Music writer Ann Powers.
His family was, essentially disenfranchised and had to leave Mississippi in order to start anew, but it wasn't easy at all.
His father, Vernon, was often out of work and occasionally in trouble with the law. His mother, Gladys, found work at a cafeteria and later as a nurse's assistant. Elvis was just trying to finish high school. He loved the gospel, blues, and country he heard on Memphis radio. The music of W. Herbert Brewster's East Trigg Baptist Church, along with the sounds of the Statesmen and the Blackwood Brothers. The teenager brought all that to Sam Phillips' studio.
Evening shadows make me blue. When each weary day is through, how I long to be with you.
At the end of the session, Sam handed Elvis a single copy of the recording. He gave it to his mother. Nobody else heard of the kid until a year later, when Sam called him into the studio and he recorded his take on a popular blues by author Big Boy Crudup.
Well, that's all right, Mama. That's all right for you. That's all right, Mama. Just any way you do, that's all right. That's all right, that's all right, Mama, anyway do. Well, Mama, she done told me, Papa done told me too. Son, that gal you fooling with, she ain't no good to you, but that's all right.
Turns out there was a massive audience for the music Elvis loved, the music Sam had set up his studio to record. But not for the black artists who inspired Elvis. White audiences only started buying after artists like Elvis came to Sun Records, followed by Jerry Lee Lewis, Johnny Cash, and Roy Orbison. Was it okay for Elvis, a white musician, to get famous off of the black musicians who did not share in that fame? Was Elvis an appropriator or a thief? Or someone who championed and gave proper credit to his musical influences? We're still working through these questions.
Once the music is in the air, there simply is no stopping it. There's no keeping it back. There's no saying, oh, this is limited to this person or this population.
Peter Grawnick wrote a critically acclaimed Elvis Presley biography, Night Train to Memphis. Grawnick told us about the singer's misgivings over what we call these days cultural appropriation.
Well, you know, I should say it's totally understandable that Elvis should be made the scapegoat. There is no question that one of the essential components of his music was the African-American tradition, but so was the Appalachian tradition, so was the gospel tradition. Is that black? Is that white? You can totally understand if you're looking for a way to describe some of the basic inequities that exist within our society. Symbolically, it makes total sense to see Elvis as embodying that. But with respect to the particular person or the particular expression of his art, I just don't think it's true.
Deborah Smith Pollard teaches English literature at the University of Michigan Dearborn and hosts gospel radio programs in Detroit.
If one is observant, going into an environment that is initially unfamiliar, but takes a lot of notes and is respectful of that culture, I can see how Elvis and many others would incorporate those moves. Some people say, yeah, not just the sounds, the moves that he saw in East Trigg. I'm not mad at Elvis, even though I'm sure there are other people who are. Elvis just happens to be, what, the king. So, yeah, he just gets a lot more spotlight, I should say, when it comes to who would you say may have borrowed heavily from the black church. Yeah, Elvis would be at the top of the list.
Train a ride, 16 coaches long.
Gospel was always at the center of Elvis' own musical tastes, and it clearly shaped his rock and roll performances. There were, of course, reasons Elvis became the first breakout rock and roll star, the face of this new hybrid music. Chuck D, founding member of the legendary rap group Public Enemy, from the 2018 documentary film The King.
He was the right person to sell and market to a white country.
For three decades, these lines from Public Enemy's Fight the Power have shaped the discussion around Elvis and appropriation.
Elvis was a hero to most, but he never meant to me. Yes, he's straight out racist. The sucker was simple and plain.
Motherfucking in, John Wayne.
Cause I'm black and I'm proud. Already I'm hyped.
My conversation never was just this white dude stole black music. I think Sam Phillips was a business guy who tried to sell those records with black folks, could not get them across. Found a guy, you know, that was able to sell a black sound with a white face. He knew what to sell to America. I think culture is culture. Culture is to be shared. You know, you see a black person playing classical piano, you can't say, you know, because he doesn't have, you know, German roots, you know, that he can't play that classical piano good as anybody else. If a person's able to do the twisted, stanky leg and it happens to be Justin Timberlake, I think it's cool.
Even as Elvis rose to stardom on rock and roll, he never turned his back on gospel music. At the height of his fame, he recorded standards like Thomas A. Dorsey's Precious Lord.
Precious Lord, take my hand, lead me on, let me stand. I am tired, I am weak, I am worn. Through the storm, through the night, lead me on.
You're listening to Saturday Night and Sunday Morning, the gospel roots of rock and soul. I'm Cece Winans. As gospel was influencing other music, it was also finding mainstream success. Rock and rollers in Memphis were making like they had gotten the Holy Spirit. At the same time, Mahalia Jackson was busy in Chicago establishing herself as the queen of gospel.
Mahalia Jackson's story is sort of the quintessential Great Migration story.
Bob Maravich is editor-in-chief of the Journal of Gospel Music. He told us how Mahalia moved to Chicago in 1927 when she was just 16 years old.
She was born in New Orleans, and her mother died when she was very young, so she was raised by her Aunt Duke. That was her nickname. She lived with Aunt Duke. And Aunt Duke was a no-nonsense disciplinarian. And so Mahalia, being young, got crosshairs with Aunt Duke a number of times. Somebody in her family had moved north to Chicago, said, hey, it's better than what you're experiencing in New Orleans. Why don't you come live here?
Mahalia told radio host Studs Terkel she had attended Mount Moriah Baptist Church.
Well, in the church, in a little church down in Louisiana, I used to sing gospel songs there, and that's how I started to singing gospel songs, spirituals, and folk songs.
When she got to Chicago, her relatives took her to Greater Salem Baptist Church, where Bob Merovich says the music and worship were very different.
Mahalia goes in there, and it's these very formal hymns and anthems, and there's no kind of congregational singing going on, but Mahalia gives her testimony, and she starts singing Hand Me Down My Silver Trumpet Gabriel, which I always said it was just like having ribs at a tea party. Just did not mix with the high-fashioned Greater Salem Baptist Church congregation.
Despite that, the pastor asked Mahalia to join the choir. A couple of years later, Mahalia met Thomas Dorsey, the father of gospel music. He spoke with Studs Terkel about working with her.
I knew Mahalia back in the early 30s or the late 20s, and I was Mahalia's pianist and her promoter for 7 years. And the first time Mahalia made an appearance in New York, I took her to New York. And she's a great soul and a great singer. And I told Mahalia back in those days, I said, I'm not able to do the things for you that I would like to do are the things that you deserve. But you have a voice that no other singer has. And someday, someone will discover you, and you will be a great singer. And she is.
What Thomas did do for Mahalia was give her his songs to sing. Songs like Peace in the Valley and Precious Lord, which she recorded in 1956.
Precious Lord, take my hand, lead me on. Let me stand. I am tired, I am weak, I am worn.
That same year, Mahalia attended the National Baptist Convention, where she met Reverend Ralph Abernathy and Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. The ministers asked Mahalia to join them in Montgomery, Alabama. The Negro citizen bus boycott there had continued for more than a year. In June of 1956, a federal court ruled that bus segregation in Alabama violated the 14th Amendment of the U.S. Constitution. The Supreme Court agreed in November. By December, little had changed on the ground. The boycott leaders invited Mahalia to lift the spirits of discouraged bus boycotters. This is a recording of a song she sang to rally them. By this time, Mahalia was a major star who sold millions of records and filled concert venues. A Sam Cooke-style career into secular music could have been hers for the taking. She told Studs Terkel she liked all kinds of music.
I just learned to sing by listening to other people on records, such person as the famous Bessie Smith and Ma Rainey and Otta Cox, and that was when I was in the South. And after I came North, I had a chance to hear Paul Robeson and Marion, and I learned...
Marion Anderson.
Yes, that's...
Now, I want to get this. Your original inspiration, musically, that is, came from the great blues singers.
From the blues singers, yes.
The difference, Mahalia said, came down to this.
I just feel good all over when I sing gospel songs.
Some church people criticized her for taking gospel music out of the sanctuary and finding success on popular music charts and at the forefront of political movements. The civil rights movement called to other artists steeped in gospel traditions. The last living sister in the Staple Singers, Mavis, remembers her family's first meeting with Dr. King in Montgomery, Alabama, after he preached the 11 o'clock service at Dexter Avenue Baptist Church.
He said, "We're so happy to have Pop Staples and his daughters here this morning." And after the service, Dr. King would stand at the door to shake the worshipers' hands as they filed out. My father, he walked past, he shook Dr. King's hand, and he went on.
After the Sunday sermon, Mavis told us Roebuck Pop Staples got on board with King's message and brought his family with him.
And that's when we started writing freedom songs. We joined Dr. King. He was just starting the movement. He was just getting started. And we joined with him. And the Freedom Highway was the first freedom song we wrote. And we just continued. We would see things in the news. We see the Little Rock Nine black children trying to integrate Central High School in Little Rock.
Decades later, she remains grateful for her family's activism.
Pops, he wrote this song, "Why Am I Treated So Bad?" And Dr. King, anytime we were going to the meetings, see, we would sing before he would speak. And he would tell Pops, he said, "Stape, you're going to sing my song tonight, right?" Pops said, "Oh, yeah, doctor, we want to sing your song."
Because the Staple Singers, Mahalia Jackson, and other gospel artists were so active in the fight for civil rights, that's where many people heard gospel music. The line blurred between the spiritual and the political. Mahalia explained this for the audience of Studs Terkel, the white host of a secular radio program who also promoted her concerts.
My God, that's the thing that gives us hopes and faith to go on. It's something like a doctor giving you one of those vitamin tablets. It revives you. As Dr. Martin Luther King said, "Walk together, children, don't you get weary." There's a great camp meeting in the Promised Land. And this Promised Land is right here in America. I was born here and ain't going here. Expect to die right here too. If they kill me for freedom, then I'll be buried on the land of free, as it is said, right in America. Because we're going to walk together right here. Sing together, shout together, and also fight together.
The public beyond black churches was not entirely comfortable with her either. People applauded her performances. But anywhere else, she told the host, she was just another black woman.
That's another thing that puzzles me. I don't know, this thing, it's peculiar. When I'm on the stage and on television and working with white people, they just hug me and love me and say I'm so wonderful and I'm so great. And then when I'm walking down the street like an ordinary citizen, they don't recognize me. And when I go into the department store in the South, they I can't get a sandwich, I can't get a bottle of pop, I got to stand, I can't even get a cab. And I'm just the Mahalia Jackson that they got through saying how wonderful I am. I don't understand this. What make people act like that?
In 1963, Martin Luther King Jr. asked Mahalia to perform at the March on Washington. Late on that August afternoon, shortly before Dr. King followed a long program of speakers, Mahalia performed two songs, How I Got Over, and I've Been Buked and I've Been Scorned.
Tell me how we got over. Lord, Lord, Lord. We had a mighty hard time coming on over.
Martin Luther King stood up to deliver his prepared remarks. On paper, the speech did not contain the words, I have a dream. King's advisor, Clarence B. Jones, recalled in a 2011 interview with NPR's Fresh Air.
He had used that phrase, I have a dream, in other speeches, and specifically he had used it in a speech he had given in June in Detroit, I think, at a place called Cobalt Hall.
That's Cobalt Hall, Detroit's longtime convention center. Jones had helped write sections of King's March on Washington address.
What happened is that as he is reading from the paragraphs which he had written, incorporating some of the language and material, which I and others has contributed, Mahalia Jackson, who was his favorite gospel singer, who had previously performed, she turns to him and she shouts to him, tell him about the dream, Martin. Tell him about the dream. And he acknowledges her and momentarily pauses. And I lean to somebody standing next to me. I said, these people don't know it, but they're about ready to go to church.
Sisters and brothers, I have a dream today. I have a dream that one day every valley shall be exalted. And every hill and mountain shall be made low. The rough places will be made plain. And the crooked places will be made straight. And the glory of the Lord shall be revealed. And all flesh shall see it together. This is our hope. And this is the faith that I go back to the South.
Memphis native and WDIA radio host Mark Stansberry recalls another day, not quite 5 years later.
I was at Lane College at the time. I had graduated 2 years and I was working as director of public relations. And I was in the faculty dining room, and I remember, I shall never forget, a student came in and said, Dr. King has been shot. And I said, what? He said, Dr. King has been shot. I believe he's dead.
Gospel music communicates good news. It offers hope in times that seem downright hopeless. During a time of profound national grief, at Reverend Martin Luther King Jr.'s funeral, Mahalia gave voice to Precious Lord.
I want you to hear my cry. Hear my call. Please just hold my hand, Lord. Lord, hold my hand. Don't let me fall.
Almost 3 years after King, Mahalia died of heart failure. At her funeral, to honor what she'd given the movement and the music, Aretha Franklin took up the song.
When my life is almost
You're listening to Saturday Night and Sunday Morning, the gospel roots of rock and soul. I'm Cece Winans. At Mahalia's funeral, one singer's tribute to another passed a torch between a generation that had struggled for racial equality and one that was beginning to benefit from the struggle.
Mahalia Jackson knew the Aretha Franklin from the time that she was a child.
Mark Anthony Neal chairs Duke University's Department of African and African American Studies.
Clearly, Mahalia was somebody that Aretha Franklin respected. And so it was perfectly natural, I think, in some ways, for her to sing at Mahalia Jackson's funeral.
2 weeks before Mahalia died in 1972, Aretha made a record that became the best-selling live gospel album of all time.
You know, Aretha sings Precious Lord also on the Amazing Grace album, but she does a version of it that connects it with Carole King's You've Got a Friend.
When you're down in trouble, you need some love and care. Ain't nothing, ain't nothing going.
And I think that performance is so critical because it acknowledges who Thomas Dorsey is. It acknowledges who Mahalia Jackson was as the person who really gave voice to the song. But it also acknowledges the impact of someone like Carole King and ultimately elevates Thomas Dorsey on the same level of what we think of as the great American songwriter that we had begun to accept Carole King as.
The emerging generation, built on the foundation of gospel innovators like Thomas Dorsey, Sam Cooke, and Mahalia Jackson. Mark Anthony Neal told us,
you can make the argument that Aretha Franklin at her peak in the 1960s did more to mainstream the traditions of black gospel music than any artist, you know, who had come before then, because she had taken those kind of gifts she had gotten from the black church and created a secular context for it. Marvin Gaye is a little less pronounced, solely because he was at a label like Motown that was much more interested in hit records and in specifically 2.5 minute hit records.
Aretha and Marvin grew up in the church.
Mm-hmm.
Aretha spoke with NPR's Terry Gross in 1999.
Certainly gospel was my background, is my background. My upbringing was in the church. We had to attend regularly. And, of course, the church provided a training ground for me, so to speak, as a young vocalist. And certainly gave me all of the spiritual values that I needed as a young lady.
Her father was the famed Baptist pastor, Reverend C.L. Franklin.
As a young girl, I certainly enjoyed watching and listening to my dad.
You know, preaching means nothing except just reciting Bible stories, unless you can make it relevant to life today.
Because she was her father's child, many of the greats saw to her musical training. Detroit gospel radio host Deborah Smith Pollard.
She would have been influenced by the great Mahalia Jackson, by Clara Ward, who for a long time apparently was engaged to her father, to the Soul Stirrers, to the Caravans. And so she would have heard that. But I always tell people that in Detroit, half the people can sing and the other half can really sing.
Marvin Gaye's father was a Pentecostal minister. He immersed his son and namesake in the harmonies and rhythms of the church meetings that sometimes gathered in their own home. You can hear the gospel influences on some of young Marvin's early Motown records.
Listen, everybody, especially you girls.
Whatever and wherever Marvin and Aretha sang, they brought the church with them. Richard Smallwood is a gospel musician and a friend of Aretha's.
Aretha never left the church because it was so much a part of her, regardless of what she was singing, regardless of the genre. Even though Ness and Dormer was gospel.
Yes, even a Puccini aria. Mark Anthony Neal.
When you think about that generation of black artists, you really can't divorce African-American musical culture from the gospel tradition. Everything in terms of the use of the black voice, that piece that I talked about in terms of melisma, this kind of style of singing behind the note, that is stuff that's all uniquely black singing connected to the black church. And whether or not you're listening to black artists who very specifically sing gospel music or come through the black church tradition, you hear those kind of elements.
Can you see?
In 1983, the NBA invited Marvin to sing at the start of its All-Star game. As he walked onto the basketball court, a drum track started up.
What so proudly we hailed at the twilight.
It was the blackest that the Star Spangled Banner had ever been performed, you know, at least in such a very public venue. You know, for folks who had listened to the Star Spangled Banner all their lives, hearing him bend those notes in the way that he did, it was almost as if they were hearing the song for the first time.
On Thanksgiving Day 2016, Aretha took to the piano before NFL fans in Detroit and a national TV audience to deliver her own star-spangled 4.5 minutes.
The Rockets!
Mark Anthony Neal.
You know, this would be one of the last really major public performances that she does. And what you hear in Aretha Franklin in those days is someone, you know, that her voice is weathered, it is matured, it's different, but she knows how to control her instrument. And again, because she's home, this is Detroit, she's a longtime Detroit Lions fan, she knows the reality of her mortality. You know, what you hear in her performance at that time, you know, is almost something akin to a homegoing ceremony.
Oh, oh, say can I, say does the star spangled banner.
Gospel is about uplift and transcendence. It inspires people and taps into deep feelings in listeners. Listeners like Richard Smallwood.
When I got to Howard University in my freshman year, Respect had just hit. And I was like, who is this singing like this? I mean, this is one of the most amazing voices that I've heard. Whenever she would come to the DMV area, we'd get our little pennies together and get the closest seat that we could at the concert, because going to see Aretha live, especially in those days, was like a revival meeting. I mean, she would go right from, you know, I've never loved a man the way I loved you, right into How Good Jesus Is. And so it was quite an experience, that emotional, powerful, anointing experience that I had never, ever, you know, experienced before.
I've been really trying, babe.
Like Sam Cooke, Marvin combined the heightened emotions of gospel performance with sexuality. Cultural scholar Mark Anthony Neal.
And this is going to sound, you know, crazy, right? But there's a way in which Let's Get It On might actually be his gospel album. But what he essentially does is elevate the pursuit of sex and sexuality on the same plane that one might think about the pursuit of religion and spirituality. He's literally trying to make this argument that religion and sex belong on the same plane.
The potent mixture of gospel feeling with secular sensuality changed American pop forever. With the way music and technology have changed, we don't just have to talk about the way these artists indirectly influence future artists. Aretha and Marvin, Mahalia and Sam have been heavily sampled. Their 1950s and 60s and 70s selves are showing up alongside today's artists in ways that combine the gospel and soul of generations past with hip-hop and other contemporary music. There isn't a facet of American music today that doesn't owe a debt of gratitude to gospel. We hear it everywhere.
It seems like blessings keep falling in my lap. It seems like blessings keep falling in my lap.
Aretha's passing invites us to reflect more deeply on the legacy she left behind. Aretha had a huge impact on my career. She taught me to give everything I have. I think that was one of the secrets that she had. She knew who she was. She knew the gifts she had. Her homegoing service showed the way she bridged multiple generations from Thomas A. Dorsey, Mahalia Jackson, Sam Cooke, and the Soulsters to the musicians today. The service included musical tributes from Faith Hill to the Clark Sisters, Ariana Grande to Stevie Wonder, and many more. This is a transcendent music. Even when this nation seems most divided and broken, as when the 44th president delivered a eulogy of 9 African Americans murdered inside their church home.
Amazing grace, how sweet the sound that saved.
The story of gospel music is the story of American pop music. It is the heart of this country's musical past, present, and future. And maybe, most of all, its soul. This hour of Saturday night and Sunday morning, the gospel roots of rock and soul was written and produced by Whitney Jones. For more stories, visit our website at xpngospelroots.org. The Gospel Roots of Rock and Soul has been supported by the Pew Center for Arts and Heritage. The executive producers are Roger LeMay and Bruce Warren. Senior producer, Alex Lewis. Assistant producer, Whitney Jones. Editor, Cheryl Duvall. Mixing by Jeff Town. Our production assistant is Rachel Ishikawa. Archival audio courtesy of NPR's Fresh Air with Terry Gross, the Studs Terkel Radio Archive, the Library of Congress, and Seattle Pacific University. Special thanks to Ann Powers, Robert Maravich, Jerry Zoltan, and Donald Dumpson. The Gospel Roots of Rock and Soul is presented in collaboration with NPR Music and produced by WXPN in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. I'm Cece Winans. Thanks for listening. I'm gonna walk me some streets of